back, boys and girls. Today, as you can see, we're going to talk about war. And usually I say, you know, or usually I feel like the subject matter I'm about to talk about is something that I want to talk about. This is one I'd rather not talk about. But I feel like if I have a routine amount of or number of thoughts about a particular subject, and I never hear anyone ever talk about it from the angle that I'm having the thoughts, that's where these deep thought episodes really come from. And war is definitely one of these things that we are being bred today to live with. And I think it's important that somebody come in here and say, whoa, look over here. You know, let's look at it from a different angle. You know, step away from war and check it. You know, most people, you know, very few people would actually say that war is good. Right? They just wouldn't say that. What I find interesting is that the people that would say that are also the same people that would say a war economy is a good economy. Really strange things like that. And obviously people who say that more often are the people that have never been to war. Because anybody who goes to war typically realizes, at least in the end, after they grow up, if they go into war really, really young, and they manage to come out with fairly a positive attitude towards or a benign attitude, they tend to grow up another decade, and they look back and they're a little concerned about what happened. But let's take a step back, as we always do on this show, and let's approach it from as far away as we possibly can in perspective. What is a war? What is it really? I guess you could say it's the minimum of two sides warring, battling, fighting each other in some form or fashion. Again, you can have financial wars, economic wars, same thing, but you can have actual blood and gore wars. And we seem to be living in a world that is packed with every form of war. The anatomy of a war that turns into battle, that turns into physical combat, is really the one I want to talk about today. Now, usually when you start talking about the validity of war, the people participating in the conversation divide into two groups, if there's any opposition at all in the conversation or the debate. You have your sort of peacemakers and your pacifists that can't imagine any reason to go to war. And then you have your super-duper alpha males who can completely understand that there are jerks out there that are greedy, that believe you're a have and they're a have-not, or it doesn't even matter how much they have. They're Alexander the Great mentality, and they just simply conquer because they're assholes. They need more. They've externalized a sense of purpose. You know, they don't have any internal purpose. Their external purpose is greed. Okay. So I'm not going to really worry about the group that's a bunch of pacifistic people. They don't appear to have any control over the world, and they don't appear to have any rationale that deals with what's going on in the world right now. And I really am trying to stay away from the ultra specifics of what's going on in the world, who's battling who and that sort of thing. What I really want to do is just get at the meat and potatoes of what war is and who makes it possible. At the fundamentals of war, you have two opinions that don't agree. And it's not just like your normal opinions that don't agree. These two groups disagree so badly that they're willing to go to blows, that neither group is able to compromise or willing to compromise to solve their problem, right? It's a little poetic. I've got black crows hanging over this episode, isn't it? They're always omens. What do you have to gain from a war? You might be able to get part or all of what you want as a result of the reason why you actually started the war in the first place, right? If you want someone else's land, You might conquer them and get all of their land. You might conquer a portion of them and get a portion of their land and just replace land for whatever metaphorical stuff that someone's fighting for. All right. What do you have to stand to lose for more? Well, the most basic definition is your life. You can lose your life to war, which is why a lot of leaders of the world have decided that most people don't want to go to war because they don't have anything to potentially gain from it. But now when you have a little war back in the day, the amount of hardware used to fight the war was pretty remedial, as 2001 A Space Odyssey sort of romanticized or even reenacted, you know, the first war for the water pool were monkeys basically yelling and shouting at each other. And then the next iteration was monkey hitting monkey with bone. I'm sure there was a fist fight in there or something, or biting before the bone actually started, but economically speaking, it was feasible. Now wars are multi-billion-dollar/multi-trillion-dollar economic forces in the world. And it was weird, when I was a kid, somebody told me that oxymoron, that ridiculous statement that a war economy is a good economy. And I still know friends to this day, even friends in their 30s, that their chest puffs up and they think they've really got the secret algorithm to a good economy figured out. But what's really strange about that is that to have a good economy and a good world, which is really what that means, people have to die constantly. And we always look back at those Aztecs that were rumored to have, you know, committed the sacrifices at the top of the pyramid, which I know you're going to think I'm crazy, but I'm not convinced any of that's true. Yes, there's drawings. Yes, there's artifacts. A little bit, but I'm not convinced that that's how they ran their world, but maybe they did. I think that stuff might have been placed there to make them look barbaric, to make you look away from the Aztec pyramids and the Aztec accomplishments. But that's exactly what a war economy is a good economy statement means. That we're essentially farming our young men and women up to the top of some proverbial war pyramid and sacrificing them so that the rest of us can live wonderful down below at the bottom of the pyramid in the economic boom and bust cycle that is the result of supposedly any mechanism that makes the economy good. Isn't that a little bit weird? So maybe a war economy is a good economy is some doublespeak mechanism that's been sold to us that is not actually the way society should engineer its economy. Well, what's the inverse? A peace economy is a good economy? Sounds a little hippie-ish, right? But maybe that is the way it works. I was born in 1969. The Vietnam War was raging. It ends, you know, roughly 74, 75, depending on what you consider to be the end of a war. And then it went into, like, the disco era, the rock era, you know, the Foreigners, the Van Halen era. You know, we went into the most incredible stretch of movies ever made, Star Wars, all the way through everything, you know, Indiana Jones, you know, basically George Lucas and Steven Spielberg's careers explode. John Carpenter's, you know, career explodes. The world was in a good place. A little bit of British Falkland Island work in the early 80s. And then the 80s for us was hair metal bands and British rock and rap. Life was good. Life was really good. And kids didn't grow up with this fear of war or the indoctrination of war. I was living in the Midwest, where the commodities of the Midwest were selling well. Oil, natural gas, all the wheat, all the agricultural crops were selling like crazy. It was good. It was a peace era. And it seemed like we're all doing pretty good. Yeah, and there's always a boom and bust cycle because that's how they run the world, right? But let's look at war from the standpoint of how does a war happen? If it costs billions of dollars, how does that happen today? You know, if you try to make a movie or a video game, or you need to raise money for any amount of money to do anything, you're looking at having to borrow money. And so without the mechanism to borrow money, you can't have a war. So it's interesting. Now, if you get two kids together, and I grew up in these worlds who are disagreeing on a playground or behind the school or on the way home from school, and they're together, and you have a bunch of people sitting behind them, and they're disagreeing about something. Someone's dating someone's girlfriend, someone just doesn't like someone's face, and everyone behind them is saying, fight, 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 fight. Then you have an enabling body that's getting them to fight. If you gave them a weapon, then the fight would get more gruesome, more horrible. What's at stake becomes more horrible. The fact that maybe someone gets fatally injured starts to ramp up. And you could think of a million ways to make that little standoff after school a horrific event for both children. But now let's say you pull them away from that group that's influencing them, right? We get out of a mob rules mentality. We get out of the Coliseum, you know, entertain us with your life's mentality. And we put them in a room. And it's one of those kind of off-pink rooms that they used to make back in the 80s to calm you down. I don't know if they make those anymore, but when you got in trouble, they'd stick you in these pink rooms, and supposedly the color pink would calm you down. It's pretty hard to be really tough in a pink room, I'll tell you that much. I've been in the pink room several times. But let's say both of you are in there, and you can't touch each other. You're constrained by some mechanism. And they're like, you can't leave until you work this out. And I don't mean you tell us what we want to hear. You actually have to be friends when this thing's over. And you have to actually work it out. Either you just get along and you, whatever the dispute is just diffuses into the universe. Or you agree to give back whatever item you think might have stolen. You agree not to covet the other guy's chick or whatever it is. Eventually, they work it out. Most cases. So war is made possible because it's made possible. It happens because it's made possible by institutions that fund wars. Now, I think the misnomer about the whole thing is that you have a war over here and a financial body over here. And the financial body is interested in making money. And all they simply do is they're completely agnostic to the situation, right? They have nothing to do with the dispute. And they simply rush in and go, hey, I'll loan you money to fight your war. You guys just get it on. And perhaps a long time ago, that was the way it was. Until this financial institution finally realized, my God, you know what? We never made more money than when these two groups fought each other and we loaned them the money to do it. Now, obviously, you can loan money to one side and another financial group can loan it to the other side. Or, if you're clever and conniving, you can loan it to both sides. And you could do it in such a way that no one could find out, you know? At least you hope, right? And then whoever wins gets to take the spoils out of the other person's purse and give it to the person who owes them money. So if you're going to fund both sides of the war and your interest rate is so high that if just one side of the war pays back, you make the profit from both sides. The profit you would have made, you know, if it was a standard deal for both sides. I have been told that the wars fought in the 1800s here in the United States, especially during the Civil War, the bankers in Europe offered Abraham Lincoln money at 3,600% interest, down to a tenth of that at 36% interest. That's a lot of money, folks. That's a ton of cash. Imagine paying $1,000 for a dollar or $3,600 for a buck. Crazy, right? But now think about it. When man kills man, there's common law that actually protects the inalienable rights of man to do that. You're not allowed to do that And because, you know, man usually wants to live themselves, they can see automatically the value of someone else's life because they're like, well, I know what I like about my life. It's called being alive. And so this coveted basic rule of balance in the universe started very, very quickly. You know, it's in the Old Testament. But you're not allowed to kill someone else. If any of us get angry or get crazy and we kill someone else, we go to jail, potentially get executed because we've committed a crime. However, if we do it under the umbrella of nationalistic lines, two countries fighting each other, then what was a sin is heroic. Isn't that weird? What will put you in jail for the rest of your life is a heroic thing. And the weird thing is, the more people you kill, you have a potential of getting rewarded with medals. Isn't that wild? You have an accolade for the rest of your life for killing people. I think that's wild. You know, usually a Medal of Honor is reserved for a heroic deed of selflessness. You know, or you might, a lot of them are given posthumously because people die in the process of getting them, you know. So how is it that we have this double standard in the world? Well, the way I think we approach it is that there's a self-defense loophole to killing someone, which I support completely. If somebody gets to a state where they believe they have the right to kill you, and especially if you haven't done them any harm or done them wrong, let's just say, I think that there's almost an immediate validation in getting rid of that human being. Now, there are plenty of exceptions to that. You know that young people lose their minds easily because they're not mature. And so there is a situation where an adult can say, well, he is really out of control right now, and he is definitely playing with life and death, and he doesn't understand he's playing with life and death, and he doesn't know the value of life because he's too young, right? So a lot of times adults can sort of, you know, dodge the bullets, as you might describe. And hopefully the kid doesn't have bullets. But if he did, you might actually have to... You abort that baby in the, what is it, the 50th trimester, right? But in a war, there's usually two parties that believe that they are sort of defending themselves. But now what's interesting is, you know, I'm always saying on the show that we didn't pick the power supplies that we use, but we're taxed for them. And there aren't choices, right? I don't get an envelope in the mail that says, would you rather buy nuclear power, or would you rather buy coal power, or would you rather buy hydroelectric or something else? You don't really have that choice. The only choice you might be able to add to your life is if you have enough real estate, you can put a windmill on your property, but everybody can put them on their homes, solar panels on their homes. And so you sort of have a little bit of choice. But when it comes to war, pretty much anywhere in the world nowadays, at least in a first world country, you don't really have a choice. Your leaders make the choice whether or not you go to war, with this illusion that somehow in the haste of that decision, you've actually cast a vote. When's the last time you've ever heard, because I've never heard of this in history, your country is being led by leaders who believe you need to go to war? And there's a process for us to immediately vote. Everybody's going to go down to the voting booths on Tuesday and vote as to whether or not we want to go to war. We don't do that. And writing your congressman, give me a break, right? There's no obligation for your congressman to pay attention to you at all. The idea that you can write your congressman and create a change is a joke in this country. It's a joke pretty much everywhere around the world, and it has been for half a century at least, right? It gives you the illusion, again, that you have a choice, but you don't. When Brady was shot in the head, when Ronald Reagan was shot by supposedly Hinckley in 1981, we automatically had gun control in this country because of a crazy nutbag who got a gun and shot supposedly the president and this guy named Brady. So now we have the Brady Bill, because of a lunatic, a guy who lived in an insane asylum with his family, who is the friends of the Bush family, right? He's let out of this funny farm on little excursions, and they happen to get him directly to the location where the President of the United States is. Somehow he gets a revolver, I think it was, and pops everybody supposedly and shoots Brady in the head in the temple. I will always contest that they meant to kill that guy, but he survived. But now we have a 7-day waiting period, which is the result of the Brady Bill. And what is that waiting period supposed to do for all of the citizens of the world? Well, at least the citizens of the United States who still have guns. They put the 7-day waiting period in so that people can't have a dispute with their spouse or their friend or any circumstance on planet Earth and immediately get a gun by walking down to the gun shop and buying a gun. It sort of gets rid of that crime in the heat of passion formula. And 7 days was supposedly a magic number to make everybody calm down. And hell, maybe it is. I sort of think a 24-hour period's definitely good. Maybe a 48-hour period might be good. And it's unfortunate that, again, the 99% of us that are buying weapons simply to defend ourselves against our government if it ever gets out of control have to wait. So for the most of us that aren't crazy, that are centered human beings, that aren't hanging out with people that make us that angry to kill, like it's pretty slim odds that you're hanging out with people that want to, you know, they go from zero to kill pretty quickly, right? But it definitely helps those folks out. So let's just say overall that's a fairly decent idea, even though it's extremely frustrating when you want to get your gun. There isn't really a 7-day waiting period for war when they decide to go. Now, no wars are ever created overnight, obviously, right? Even if they claim in history to have been sort of overnight wars. But we don't have an engaging process in this world. You know, it's interesting because the parliament in England just voted to bomb Syria. And again, there's no vote from the people to the parliament to say we're going to allow you to have that choice to vote on whether or not we go to war. And now there is this rationale that the citizens of a particular country are not informed enough to know whether or not we should go to war, that there are these invisible layers of intelligence that really determine whether or not we need to go to war, which means we're not informed as people, which means as people we have allowed a class structure of intelligence and information to be coveted at the top of this pyramid, the pyramidion, right, to take all of us to war. And it's a long overdue joke that politicians don't send their children to war. You know, the if you haven't seen the lyrics to Black Sabbath's War Pigs, you got to go read them, like right away after this video. I'll start this video with War Pigs. Politicians hide themselves away. So now, let's continue. There was a bombing in Oklahoma City back in 1995, blamed on a guy named Timothy McVeigh. And there's a tremendous amount of evidence that that morning was nothing like what you saw, right? But I won't get into that. But what did they do with his buddy Terry Nichols and some other third party that supposedly contributed purchasing weapons and giving them to these two individuals to build a bomb and do all kinds of stuff, right? I guess not weapons, but, explosive stuff. They tried to find those people and put him in jail. And Terry Nichols, I think, he's either in jail for life or he was executed. I can't remember which one. I know that McVeigh was obviously executed, supposedly. So aiding and abetting a war, or excuse me, aiding and abetting a murder, excuse me, is illegal. Aiding and abetting after the fact is illegal. So if you know that a murder happened and you conceal that and no one knows who the murderer was, but you know who it was and you didn't say anything, you're just as guilty as the person who did it virtually, right? And we as a society at our level of the pyramid, we don't want people walking around with sidearms willy-nilly killing everybody. Now, it never happens like that because an armed society is usually the safest society. Statistics are coming out like crazy right now that all the areas of the world that are the most violent are those that are disarmed. Chicago has the highest crime rate in America right now per capita of people. Well, they disarmed that city. They took away their constitutional rights. And for some reason, there's enough fluoride in everyone's head to be docile to that violation of their constitutional rights, for God's sakes. It's really weird how these double standards just happen. Strange, right? Nowhere in American soil can any human being be denied the constitutional rights that are in my area of America. Doesn't mean there couldn't be a disaster and there might be curfew and martial law in a particular area. But just as a day-to-day thing, it doesn't make any sense, right? So why is it that at our level, we consider murdering someone a crime? We consider aiding someone to create a to commit a murder a crime. We consider those who hide it after the fact to be criminalistic. Those three different tiers, right? Well, why is it that when it goes to the chapter of reality, which is war, that none of those acts are considered illegal? War is legal. And it used to be that you were a war crime person if you engaged in an irrational war. Hitler was considered a war criminal and all of his minions because they rose up out of their country with this doctrine of Arianism, and they went after Poland, they went after every country in Europe. They were aggressors. They took away other people's sovereign rights. They're the war criminal. As we remember them, that's how they're written in history. Okay. But why wasn't it, and why isn't it, the fact that those who funded Hitler were never tried for war crimes? Those who aided their escape and laundered their war chests were never considered criminals. Because at the level of war, you're dealing with individuals that pretty much have all the power, right? I just think that's a little bit strange, and we don't think about it very often. And some people in the conspiracy circles definitely talk about it. But a war can't exist without a bank somewhere on planet Earth financing the war. All right. A lot of people don't understand and don't know the history that George Herbert Walker Bush, his father, Prescott Bush, through the Union Bank of London, funded Hitler until 1942. And it wasn't until someone came in the Union Bank of London and threatened to close it down, seize all the assets, and put everyone in jail if they don't cease funding Hitler, that he stopped. And that's because they did it through a commercial enterprise that was very easy to find and very easy to track. It doesn't mean that the wealth and the money didn't get filtered through some other corporation and get to him some other way. But that guy's son and grandson has been the president of the United States. Isn't that weird? Right? You have Arnold Schwarzenegger, who runs around with his SS skull and crossbones belt buckle and ring. He's on the front of Forbes magazine, I think, with the belt buckle. He's been other photo shoots with the ring because his father, was a neo-Nazi. And some offshoot thing. And of course, they always just say, well, a lot of kids, a lot of innocent kids. And it's true. A lot of innocent kids were indoctrinated. And they went into this war. Okay, fine. I don't really blame anyone for being a descendant of someone who's bad. How could you, right? If Charles Manson had a kid, it wouldn't necessarily be Charles Manson, even though he personally didn't kill anybody. But to run around with the paraphernalia of what is clearly communicated to the world as a Holocaust, isn't that a little bit strange? Arnold Schwarzenegger is a revered screenplay actor for thriller movies. He's been in comedies. He's been the governor of the state of California. California. Odd, right? So I wanted to come in this way because I want you to see the fact that without bankers loaning money, not even the United States of America, who's horribly, horribly in debt, could ever finance a war. And no one else could either, to be honest with you. All they do is borrow against their grandchildren's futures, maybe their grandchildren's grandchildren's futures, to fight these wars today. So that's your first thing. So you have this financial institution in the world that aids and enables an otherwise impossible scenario, which is war. Now, I know what you're thinking. Some of you are thinking, well, it's damn good that they can do that because we really have serious problems. Aren't you looking at what's going on in the world? We're going to get to that in 1 second, too. We also have individuals that know all kinds of terrible facts about wars, who did them, how they got started, and we essentially write them blank checks, too. They're allowed to know a bunch of coveted information that may be, I don't know, the difference between the war being legal and the war being illegal. A lot of you will remember General Colin Powell walking into the United Nations in New York City and claiming to the entire world that he had conclusive proof that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. More specifically, chemical weapons, chemical and biological weapons, and potentially nuclear weapons. And Saddam himself had bragged that he had some pieces and parts of nuclear weapons. He actually held up a few, what he claimed to be like triggers. Whatever. We now know that none of that stuff existed. We now know that Saddam Hussein never ever used that on our troops. There was a situation where Saddam used that on some Kurds, which is the population on the north tip of Iraq. But we also know that Donald Rumsfeld went over and sold that to him in the 80s and got the little photograph of him shaking Saddam Hussein's hand. And that was during an arms deal of chemical weapons. So one person sold him the weapons, and then because he used them, we demonized him. And later on, 15, 20 years later, we accused him of still having them. Now, I'm not trying to say that these guys are, these potentially bad guys were good guys. I'm just saying that that was a lie. Now, some of you are going to say, well, you're an idiot. You have to fight fire with fire. We can't follow a bunch of rules while the guys that fight us don't follow any rules. Hey, man, you have my complete support in that. I just think that it might change who we fight if we knew the facts. And because we don't, we're not allowed to have the facts as a matter of national security, your certainty about who is bad and who is good is probably very, very subjective and very, very built on indoctrination. Now let's look at it from an instance of why we fight wars today. Because if you've watched my shows, you know that there's a very specific formula that we believe in at MKUltra. Now, I told you before that if you were the lone institution that financed wars, then you would understand very quickly that you probably would make the most amount of money financing a war, because it's sort of a reactionary, almost Vegas casino scenario of being addicted to spending money. If you were going to build a business of any kind, hopefully you'll strategically plan your business, find your clients, determine what your services or products are, find the cheapest way to manufacture your products or services at the highest level of quality, start engaging, you know, open the doors, and run your company very lean. As lean as you possibly could. That's your job as the CEO, is to spend as little money as possible and earn as much money as possible and not compromise the well-being of your employees and the quality of what you're offering the world, right? It's a very meticulous process. But when you talk about a war, you have financial institutions which say, well, money's fake. We've been given the monopoly on making this fake money. you've accepted the fact that in your mind, we're the only people allowed to make money, which is a crazy thought in itself. And as long as you can find a reason to drop a bomb, build a bomb, push a soldier onto the field, we will continue infinitely giving you money. Because in the end, the bond that you've signed with me, the contract you've signed with me, in order to guarantee that I have from you to pay it back, which oddly is not your bank account, Mr. General. Oddly, it's not your bank account, Mr. Senator, Congressman, House Representative. What's going to regulate that process? And I'm going to tell you, nothing ever has, ever. The day before 9/11, September 10th, 2001, Donald Rumsfeld went in front of the press, and he was addressing a $4.4 trillion deficit of lost invoices, lost money that the Pentagon borrowed. And I don't know what the duration of this money was that it was borrowed and spent. It was $4.4 trillion. And what they managed to do was cook the books and get rid of 2.2 of the 4.4. So 50% of that of the books were somehow erased, you know, through whatever financial means. But he was addressing the public, I believe. There is a press conference, you can see it. But I think the number that he was talking about was $2.2 trillion. Now, consequently, one of the most interesting facts about the Pentagon getting hit was that all the paperwork to investigate that accounting anomaly was literally put right where whatever hit the Pentagon hit the Pentagon, and it was all vaporized and blown up. Investigation concluded. Well, that's amazing, right? But guess what? The debt still existed. The deficit of this country still absorbed that project, whatever that was, whether or not it's a bunch of people. And we hear about it all the time, right? We hear about it, Secret Service and politicians running around buying prostitutes, staying in these credible hotels, using all the money of the state or the government to fly in first-class private jets from point A to point B. We find that this is in the newspapers constantly, right? Well, war is that times 10, if not more. So what if we as the people of this world were to require a few things? Let's just say we widen the definition of war crimes a little bit. That's the first step we might want to do. We say that any financial institution that finances a war from any angle, whether it be a Sultan family or a banking cartel in Europe, or your Uncle Joe that just has billions and billions of dollars, if anyone gives a country money to fight a war, especially as a loan with interest, maybe you can donate the money. Who knows, right? But you become a war criminal. Especially if you're the aggressor. It would change the terrain of war. It would change any aggressive action in the world because you become a criminal, sought after by the entire world population as a criminal. And what if, as a result of international law, we said that for any country to conduct a war, to declare war, or behave like they're in war, the people of that country have to be given a chance to vote. And let's just say a two-thirds majority would be necessary to authorize a war from the people, not from their constituents, but from the people, just like a presidential vote. Now, given that the last four elections have been this ridiculous 50-50, astronomically impossible total, from both Bush elections, both Obama re-elections, or elections, I should say, they've been 50-50. Unbelievable, impossible odds, four times in a row. I don't think you'd get a two-thirds majority on basically any form of aggression. That would really change the landscape of the world, wouldn't it? But I know what some of you are thinking, because you know the technicality that's upon us today. We don't declare war anymore. We do not declare war And even if we do, we declare it on an ambiguous group of people that aren't a nation. And so all of the international war laws, war crime laws, regulations of conducting war do not apply, and they never apply. Think about it. So if, as long as we go after organizations like Al-Qaeda, ISIS, anyone, they're not real legitimized nation states. They're phantom factions that are always managed to get inside of a camera that hits your press, but the military can never find them. You know, like I said before, ISIS always gets filmed doing things. A lot of us believe that that is a construct of a couple military intelligence agencies working together to get other things to happen in the world, which I'm going to get to at the end of this thing. But if you think about it, there's all this press about ISIS destroying some artifacts in Syria. There was a temple that for 3 days, all right, ISIS destroyed this temple. And they've just destroyed supposedly museums, and even the Taliban blew up amazing sculptures in mountainsides. Now, a one-off is understandable. They film their own work, and it's all finished, and they simply release the footage of what they did. That's a way they could pull it off, and we wouldn't know that they had done it until they had done it, right? But the one that happened in 2015, where they went after a temple, it was reported the day they started, and it was continually reported for 2 more days. But our military couldn't find them. That's sort of a problem in logic, isn't it? If somebody said ISIS is destroying the Statue of Liberty for 3 days, and there's beautiful HD photographs of them doing this on the first day, and the military-industrial complex throws their hands up and goes, man, if we could only find ISIS, we could wipe them out. You would immediately understand the craziness that we live in today, because the exact same scenario is true today. Vladimir Putin, the head of the Russian government at this point, has had no problem finding ISIS in every single nook and cranny in Syria. And I mean no problem at all. Right after Turkey shot down one of their fighters and cowardly shot the parachuting pilot with guns, killing one of them, the co-pilot, Putin changed the tactics on the war. And Putin started hitting things that he knew existed because he was trying to play along with the bigger game that's going on in the world. But what did he immediately start doing? He started bombing all the oil refineries, the tanker trucks, all the oil that's being stolen out of northern Syria and smuggled through Turkey. He knew it was there the whole time. He just didn't stoop to that level because he thought, okay, we know what you're doing, guys. We know that you're stealing the oil. We know this. It's old news. We're just going to knock out all these cells such that you can have all this oil, but you won't have your terrorist faction to rationalize attacking Syria further, because we're going to wipe them off the map. And then when you say you're trying to attack ISIS in Syria, they're not going to be there. Eventually, the Syrian army would roll up their landscape and take back all the refineries and take back all the tankers, and it would just naturally and peacefully calm down. But when Turkey cowardly shot down this fighter, which posed no threat to Turkey whatsoever, Russia said, all right, game on. I'm putting 150,000 troops in northern Syria, and I'm wiping out on the first week after that 1,000 oil tankers. And even if your tankers are working, I'm bombing the oil refineries and the storage facilities. So good luck. Good luck, Turkey, smuggling, what is it, $85 million of oil a day out of that place. I think it's probably a lot more, but that's what was going on. But I mentioned these banks, and I alluded very, very closely to it. Now we're going to go right into it. We all know that when you have money, You have power. And what I like to tell my friends is if you had $5,000 in this world, you could pretty much get anybody killed in the entire world. Because there's somebody that'll do it for $50 to $500, go to a third world country and find someone. And with the remaining money, you can buy a plane ticket anywhere on the planet. If the guy has no record, you can definitely get him the visas he needs to visit on a vacation. You can give him a fake wife if you need to, fake kids if you need to. You can put that guy in someone's backyard, and for that little tiny amount of money, they're willing to commit a capital crime, murder. Now imagine you have trillions. Imagine you have quadrillions, which is really the self-admitted value of some of these families. A single family has claimed that today they should have essentially so much money that it's more money than has ever been created in world history. It's worth more than any of the gold that's ever been captured or, you know, precious commodities. And you might be asking, what the hell are you talking about? Well, the Rothschilds told us, again, I think the Rothschilds do exist. There's plenty of old documentation and stuff. There's Rothschild people walking on the planet Earth, right? But they claimed in the 1800s, in the mid-1800s, that they were worth about, I think it was $6.5 billion. In the mid-1800s, that's insane, right? I think you could eat a full meal for a couple pennies, right? Now, if you put that in a calculator and you average up, I think it's 4% is the way you can do this. Let's just say they never engaged in another action of business except just investing their money around the world to make 4% a year. And you put that in a calculator and you just keep hitting, you know, multiply, added 4% to it. And of course, the number gets bigger and you multiply that number times 4%. It's a recursive algorithm of annuity. If you get to, way before you get to 2015, your calculator starts erroring out. It starts going into exponential numbers because it has to struggle to show you the number. Last time I did it was probably 10 years ago, and I got into the quadrillions. Just with that first number, amortizing of 4% a year. All right, well, there's not that much money in the world. There never has been that much money in the world. So we can assume that whatever they've been doing, they don't have that much money in any bank account anywhere, but they wouldn't need that much. That's just one family. That's just one family from a long time ago. And they've never suffered any cataclysmic financial ruin. There's not a chapter in history that says this is the day that the Rothschilds lost all their money. That day has never been written in history. And it's not been written for the Habsburgs, the Windsors, the king and queens that still run over Spain, you know, Norway, etc., etc. These families have never suffered any cataclysmic financial collapse, ever. So we have to assume that these individuals have more money than pretty much everyone in the world. And because we know the law of money and power going together, the mindset of an individual who has that much power is completely different than the average Joe. Okay? So what if you wanted to keep that power? What if you wanted to keep that power in your circle? It doesn't matter if you have goodwill towards men or bad will towards men. You still have this power. And in order to keep that power through a financial means, war is a great way to do it. Now, war was an imperative a long, long time ago when man fought over land, when people like Alexander Great went around and just, who's, you know, revered as some hero in history. The guy was a jerk. He went around destroying worlds to feed his ego. Now, he lost a bunch of wars, too, that they don't tell you about, right? Sort of what 300's about in a metaphorical way, even though it's the Spartans. Alexander tried to push east and lost. All right. And their history books actually have his losses very well documented. Neither here nor there. Okay. If you learn that the easiest way to make cash was to finance wars, but everyone seemed to calm down, then what do you do? What do you do if everyone wants to get along? Because just like Joseph Goebbels said, nobody wants to go to war because the only thing they have to gain is everything they had before they went to war. But everything they have to lose is everything. You know, what they have to lose is everything. All right, that doesn't sound like very good odds. I could die and lose my life, which is the ultimate commodity I have possession of. Or I could just simply come home and stay in my house and the exact way it was the day I went to war. So now let me think about this and let you think about this for 1 second. If war makes these people continually have infinite cash and infinite, aka power, then would they ever want the world to be peaceful? Would that ever happen? I think at face value, we can say no. Now, what if after you have power, you have to build an apparatus, a bunch of mechanisms to control the population that you do control, to essentially exercise your power? And let's say that that's a messy, messy job. 200 years ago for sure. 200 years ago, it's really difficult to control the people because they have their own sovereign opinions, because there's still this thing called rights that exist. And with this horrible, horrible experiment called America, which is nothing more than an idea of freedom, Magna Carta for Europeans, right? We have to convince these people to continually disagree with each other until we get to a point where we can control them. And then we can have peace in the world, but it's only going to be under this control mechanism where we remain on the top of the pyramid and they're at the bottom of the pyramid. Okay. Now, before we go into the way they would treat society, let's go into how they treat our soldiers globally. Even an Israeli soldier who just recently protested in a court and did a beautiful job. What happens to a soldier that gets injured in this world? Well, since America's fighting most of the wars right now and has over the last God knows how many decades, we potentially have the best education on what happens to a soldier once they get hurt. Now, empathetic, sympathetic soul that would have the audacity or maybe the necessity to say, I'm old, I can't fight, but I can guide us to the most utopian, peaceful world if you're just willing to get rid of this one aggressor. We need to fight a war. This one country is keeping us from this utopian world that we're all striving for. And that person goes off and fights the war and makes a dent in the war at least. And then they get injured, maybe psychologically, maybe biologically, or maybe both, right? And they come back injured. They've lost a limb. They don't think clearly. They hear bombshells. You know, they've seen things that they can't unsee, which terrify them at night when they go to sleep. You would assume that as someone who was calling on these soldiers to fight on their behalf would at least say, look, I've got plenty of money, okay? And we've got great hospitals. We have great psychiatric wards. We're going to get you healed up as a concession for risking everything in your life. And because some of you guys are maimed now, you don't have arms, legs, eyeballs, and mental health, you deserve the top care that we can give you for risking your life for us. Now, we know that the bodies that enable war have plenty of money. We know that we have plenty of facilities in the world to do this. But we know it doesn't happen. Here in America, over the last decade, and this has been going on for decades, but over the last decade in America, we have had the veterans' hospitals exposed for not taking care of our soldiers. There are wives out there making videos about how their husbands came home mentally impaired with the post-traumatic stress of war, and they commit suicide, leaving a family, a wife, and children behind. This is happening today. And no one's swooping in to fix anything. One of Donald Trump's big campaign promises is to get the VA hospitals refunded, you know, to get funded again. And we have a president, we have a bunch of senators, we have a bunch of House of Representatives, and they aren't remotely trying to get this job done. And yet they're asking people to shovel their children into these wars just like coal into a furnace. Now, I think we can all agree that if any one faction in society is going to be taken care of as a result of their sacrifice for their country, it would be our soldiers. And again, recently, a Israeli soldier who fought the Palestinians recently was in court, and he's like, look, he testified in court that he's extremely injured mentally and physically, that he struggled to get hospital care and psychiatric care. He regrets a lot of the actions he did to the Palestinians. And he screamed and yelled. I take it was in Hebrew, but I watched him. He was very passionate about this whole thing. But he couldn't get the care that he needed. And most of us envision Israel being a very well-oiled machine. And I never knew that they had the same VA problem that we have, right? So if that's the way that the people who finance war and the people who decide at the top of our countries to have war treat a soldier, someone who gives them their power to be these warmongering people or these war-enabling people, if that's how they're going to treat a soldier, then what would make you think for a split second that if we're ever the victors in these wars, that the citizens way down at the bottom of the pyramid that never engage war, that never pick up a gun, never go to basic training, for whatever reason, are going to deserve more than the soldier who made it all possible for them to get their power out of the universe? I think that would be very silly. Now, if our soldiers were well taken care of, we could assume that they would also take care of us if we were to be the victors in any one particular war, any one particular agenda. But they've already exposed their mentality. They've already exposed the fact that they don't care. And I think you need to remember that when you enable your country to go to war. But now, let's think about the ecosystem of those that fund war. What is their ecosystem of power? I think we've already talked about it. It's money. Money allows those who are in power who fund wars to stay in power. If whatever gives their money value disappears, well, then they disappear. Their power structure disappears. Interesting, right? I think it's pretty conclusive that most of the wars, if not every single one of the wars that we fought for several decades, off and on, different factions, but especially right now, last 15 years of war, this country, America, has been fighting, it was interestingly brought out in Sacha Cohen's movie, The Dictator. The whole movie is Sacha Cohen, who plays, obviously, many of Barat, and he plays just a ton of characters, right? His movie was about the fact that his country, his Middle Eastern country, of course, he dressed up like Saddam Hussein so everyone could understand it, but their country was being taken over by the bankers of Europe. And the big goal was to get their leader to sign a new constitution to the IMF, to essentially surrender the leadership to them and to surrender their financial mechanisms to them. That's what the whole film's about, but everybody misses it. His closing speech in the third act really just calls everything out, exactly as it's really happening in this world. It's interesting. Now, what if you were to, you're just rich, right? You're just rich. And you start funding movies, but you don't know anyone in the movie industry, but you've got money. And you got one friend in the movie industry that's going to get your money to the right place. Well, don't you think if you did this for 50 years, 100 years, 200 years, and you saw people come and go in the industry and you got more and more involved by funding things, maybe you lost some money, made some money, don't you think at some point you would eventually know everybody in the industry of movies? And you might actually get to the point where you have caught up with all the potential investments when you got started, and you would eclipse at one point the opportunity to start something new. Now, if you're just funding someone else's idea, then someone else has already written the script. Someone else is being cast as the, the actors and the writers and the directors and the DP and all that stuff. What if you get so embedded over the centuries that you can hire and fire those people? Maybe, you know a better director now because you've seen how bad directors came in and pitched films and flopped. Maybe you get better at understanding what a good script is. You would embed yourself over years into that industry to the point you technically, proverbially own the industry. Okay. Well, now let's take that whole mechanism that you understand and let's apply it to war. You're a banking institution that started off loaning kings and queens money. You didn't really get involved with what they were spending their money for. You were happy when they came to you to borrow for war because you knew you're going to make a lot of money. But over the centuries, you met the leaders. You maybe even helped fund a leader get into office over another leader. You start to liaison with the generals. You start to find out how the generals do their thing. You start to find out their qualifications to be a general. You start to find out, well, this general did what I made me a lot of money because he kept the war going because he had a certain mentality of war. And this other general actually negotiated with the other side and shut my war down, so I made less money. Damn it. Right? If you're these power-hungry people, you're angry when the war gets shut down, when a negotiation or a treaty happens. That's all your money going out the door. Instead of basically saying, hey, let's finance both countries to grow their national product and get a higher educated people. Because you know that you, the more that you would educate the citizens of a particular country, their lust for war would go down. So you wouldn't want that. You'd want people uneducated and technically indoctrinated in any belief system that would fuel war, that would fuel disagreement. Well, then you'd have to at some point find paradigms of thought that that conflict with other paradigms of thought. Right? Well, you have a couple choices at that point when you realize that conflict makes you money and money makes you powerful. You can either invent constructs and belief systems and paradigms to indoctrinate citizens around the world to disagree, or you could co-opt the ones that already exist. What's going on in the world right now in 2015? It's a religious war. It's a philosophical war. Philosophically, people decide to run their country one way or the other. They decide to give equal rights to their citizens. They decide to get the discrepancy between the rich and the poor balanced out. But religion is an awesome one, right? Because everyone thinks their religion is the way they want to live their lives. And most of them haven't seen the other side. You know, and again, right now we've got some extremist stuff going on. So it's very simple to say we like women to have rights. And, you know, we don't believe in infidel passages in the more modern first world countries, you know. So the pretense of everything that's going on right now in the common thought process of man is a religious war. You're Islamic extremists, right? The religion of war. And then you have, I guess nowadays, we consider Christianity to be a religion of peace. Even though they were responsible for some horrific things for the first 1,500 years, it's all sort of calmed down now. You might disagree with another Christian. You might disagree between a Christian and atheist, but it doesn't usually turn into war, you know? So you might, as a power structure over the world, exacerbate those disagreements as a cover story to simply keep war going and to make money. But what if there were some guys with their own countries and they were like, well, we know we're different than you, but we don't think we need to fight over it. And we just so happen, okay, we just so happen to have access to this stuff called oil. And consequently, the thing that makes your money, we're talking to the top of the pyramid in Europe, the thing that gives your power, or money, excuse me, any power, is in value, is because you got the entire world strung out on oil, right? Planes, jets, cars all run on some derivative of oil. They're even lubricated with oil. A lot of homes in America still run on oil. It's crazy to heat their house. When I first heard that New York has tons of neighborhoods where people have the oil truck show up to their house and plug a big hose into the side of their house and fill it with oil, and that stuff's burned, and that's how their house gets warm in the winter, my jaw hit the ground. I was like, I lived in New England and there was nothing like that anywhere where I was that I knew of, right? So we're strung out on oil. We're strung on plastic, right? Plastic's a huge oil derivative. We have medicines that are made with oil now. The whole planet's ingesting this stuff like crazy. And of course, we have this this guilt trip that we didn't choose any of this stuff, but we're going to have to pay carbon taxation because we use this stuff around the world. It's not just oil, but again, we didn't choose any of this stuff. But let's say the Middle East goes, well, we know we don't believe what you believe, but again, we're minding our own business for the most part. You know, the years of the Middle East rising up and moving into Europe with, you know, pikes in their hands to take over that land, which they did a lot of in the last 1,000 years, it sort of all calmed down. But now they say, look, we're gonna take away your power because you're crazy, right? You've started all these wars in the Middle East to do what Sacha Cohen referred to in his movie, The Dictator, which is that you're rationalizing to your people through religious indoctrination, whether it be Christianity or another religion, which is, could be a financial religion, could just be, you know, good old fashioned agnostic atheists' beliefs on how to run the world, give people equal rights, that kind of thing. So we demonize these countries for their differences in beliefs. I'm not saying you have to approve of their way, but it's their way. And we build up artificial threats about them, getting nuclear weapons and what have you. All right. And we push the wars over into their area with catalyzing events like 9/11, something that the neocons wrote about and said that we would need another Pearl Harbor before we'd ever be able to execute Zygmunt Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard, to go after all the oil in the Middle East, thus securing the power of money for the top pyramid people in Europe that financed the wars so they could achieve their definition of utopia, which, remember how they treat soldiers. They can't be possibly planning to treat citizens any better than they treat the soldiers. And since they don't really care about a soldier the second he becomes unable to help them fight wars, right? A second that an asset of war gets disabled by war, they're lucky if they ever get the medical care to ever get healed again. It's sort of like, get that guy out of here. Don't spend any money on him. Get him out of here. Now, of course, there are exceptions to the rule. People have been injured, have got great care. So you're lucky if you're one of those people, right? But could it be possible that the wars that are invented today are invented by those who just want to keep the power at the top? They need oil to be regulated in supply, which then drives up demand, which then drives up the value of the money that's being sold, the petrol dollar, or the oil-backed currency, as we call it in America. So could it be that the world right now is in nothing more than a perpetual motor of war generated by those who fund war, who are really enjoying their power by the financial gains from war, and that the apparatus that they use to control the civilizations that they control, as they are threatened by those from the Middle East to remove their power or weaken them considerably, they are now pushing all of our kids into those areas. And again, like I said about midway through this episode, what factions do we fight without declaring war that are disabling these countries and causing the Sacha Cohen dictator third act to occur? Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And if Al-Qaeda, which is now pretty much off the map, in fact, now we're talking about funding Al-Qaeda to get rid of ISIS. Crazy, right? If ISIS were to ever lose because of Putin, or Al-Qaeda gets wiped out at the same time due to Putin, or anyone else, right? China, the Middle East simply gets rid of them. You better believe there'll be a third faction with a new name and a new bunch of beheadings and a bunch of other rationalized videos to get us to go to war. But what happens to us citizens as a result of going to these wars? Because we think that we have to go to war in order to stay free. Well, we already talked about the soldiers. The soldiers are entirely marginalized the second they get injured. All right. What about the citizens? Well, in America, it's pretty much been conclusively proven that 9 of the 10 Bill of Rights, which are inalienable rights as exist as being human beings on this planet, have been compromised right in front of our very eyes. We no longer have a Fourth Amendment, which says you can't eavesdrop on us. It's a constitutional right that's being violated, that has been violated way before 9/11, but definitely in our face since the Military Commissions Act mandated it in all communications companies to steal our private information. There's surveillance technology that if you have any camera in your house on a computer and it's connected to the internet, well, they can turn it on and look through it. They've admitted this. They've admitted they can actually look to your camera on your telephone, even if it's technically powered down, as long as the power supply is still inside. Well, you can't pull a power supply out of an iPhone. You could pull it out of an Android, but since all of us have cases because the glass breaks, it doesn't really break on Androids, but it breaks all the time on iPhones. You don't do it. You don't take any power supplies out. And we shouldn't. We shouldn't have to because we shouldn't be surveillanced. They've admitted they can listen to any camera or any microphone. The PlayStation 4 and the Xbox, the latest Xbox, now has to be connected to the internet to work. And they have camera devices that ship with these products. So they can always look at your living room. Most televisions have cameras in them to sense whether or not someone's in the room, whether or not they should turn it on. So a lot of TVs have voice-activated commands now. Your photo software, at least on a Macintosh, always scrapes your face and your GPS coordinates and the time of day that every photograph was ever taken. Same with iMovie. Starting to get the point here. Drones that fly over the United States of America, which can be controlled by foreign soldiers in a different country, they have no moral obligation to Americans. They could bomb an American neighborhood with a drone. They don't care. They're not American. How much sweat would roll down the brow of an American bombing some other foreign country? If someone just simply said, well, in this country in Europe, there's this horrible faction that is actually a terrorist faction. You don't get any background on what actually makes them a terrorist. And you're between the age of 19 and 23, which means you haven't really grown up enough to have your own value of life. And if you went into basic training at 18, well, your likelihood of ever getting that value of life until you get out of the military is going to be 10 years out. So you do all your killing as a kid before you think it through. Later on, you regret it for the rest of your life. If you grow a moral bone in your body, we're not in control of our own psyche. Like I said before, I met a woman in the Game Developers Conference, GDC, in San Francisco, a woman from the most covert Air Force base in England, like our Area 51, and she bragged to me that you couldn't get on the base unless you had permission from the military. She bragged that Tony Blair didn't have the rights to walk on that base. And the same thing with Obama trying to walk on Area 51. There are shadow agencies over these covert organizations that are higher than the supreme commander of our country. Jimmy Carter wanted to go to Area 51 right after he got elected, and they wouldn't let him land. And hell, that place was about 40 years old by the time he got in there. At least 30 years old. So, war. As the game Fallout says beautifully, war, it never changes. It's always the same. We don't choose war, people. Other people choose wars for us. We don't benefit from war anymore. We lose everything when it happens. We lose our rights. And because people are easily scared in this universe, they're willing to give away their rights. Because they're attempting to get back to the sovereign, beautiful world that is the utopia, that is the idea of America, which is based on Magna Carta. There could be probably no subject more important to discuss with your friends than the stuff in this video. To get people to see things for what they really are, as opposed to the propaganda that it's being pitched to us as. Unfortunately, we're actually in a war right now. We're in a big war right now. And it's sort of so chaotic and hard to follow. And because those who are supposed to serve us are involved with the whole thing, right? We can't find those people that are causing it as easily as we used to. Or they've been able to put themselves in positions where they are perceived as the good guys when they're actually the bad guys. Right? And any politician that ever were to try to run for office under the pretense of ending wars, and especially in America, getting us out of being the police state around the planet. Well, the big game is that we have our power structure because of the gross national product and value of the United States dollar, which is fueled by the sale of a barrel of oil. Because we've allowed our world to be turned upside down and valued in such a way, those in the know, they know one thing. If we don't continue to fight these bloodbaths for oil regulation, that Americans will no longer be able to be these entitled creatures that only worry about the latest sports score. They worry about when their next television show comes on TV. They worry about the next iPhone that's coming out and they stand in line for a month. All that freedom will go away if we stop fighting wars until we re-engineer this country with super intelligent people who actually invent products that people want to buy outside of the paradigm of war, and we sell it to other countries because we have the patents towards creating it. Anyone who steals our patents, we don't sign preferred trading agreements with those countries. We say, if your people keep stealing our software, our hardware, our military inventions, if we even catch you creating any of this stuff without being told to by us as a manufacturing partner, we're going to cut off our country from ever buying any of your products. And then you can see where you exist in the grand scheme of things on planet Earth. Murder is illegal unless it's done through the paradigm of war. And all of the ancient history where that has become that has been an imperative to exist, well, it's no longer as cut and dry as it used to be. And I think that everyone listening from the MKUltra channel understands this wholeheartedly before I said anything. But I wanted to give you a clean perspective, a clean build-up to the lunacy that is our planet at this point. You know? If we keep perpetuating comments like a war economy is a good economy, then we're buttoning up this lunacy and selling it to humanity. And we are, you know, for anyone who says that and believes that, all right, especially those who profit from war, you know, you'll have a meatpacking company that sells, MRIs, these little ration food packets to the government for war, you know, so our soldiers can eat. And obviously, our soldiers need those things, but they'll fund war. They'll keep the paradigm going because they're getting their short-term gain of financial power in their own little way, wherever they live, by means of war. And we know that the biggest corporations in the Dow of the New York Stock Exchange, well, almost every single member of Dow, which is like 30 stocks, right? It's like 27 to 30 stocks. They're all embedded into this ecosystem of war. So you think it's going to stop? It ain't going to stop until, I don't know, maybe women cut men off. Maybe the women could change the world by saying, oh, you want some of this? Well, you got to stop doing that. But maybe all these religious institutions, which exacerbate the differences between our world and their world, can calm down a little bit. But now again, we're being infiltrated by factions that, quite frankly, may have been duped. Maybe they are legitimate people from these Middle Eastern countries that are now infiltrating all these first world countries. And maybe they're going to bring us a little flavor of what they do. You know? We've got a horrible cycle going on right now. And we've gone over there and we've bombed so many cities indiscriminately, telling the citizens of the countries that finance all these bombs and all these sorties that were definitely killing the bad guys. Well, let's say that we 90% of the time we're correct, which I don't think we are, but let's say 90% of the time we do just kill these horrible human beings, these mercenaries that go over and just fight for money and just cause a bunch of problems in the world. All right, that leaves 10% of innocent people, collateral damage. What happens to a kid who loses his mother and his father to one of these bombs, and there's eight brothers in the family, or even a couple sisters that are going to pump out kids? They're going to tell their kids, the reason why you've never met your grandmother and your grandfather is because this country over here, in this first world country, rationalized bombing us. And we had nothing to do with what they said that we were involved in. Those kids are going to become our enemies and live a full life, probably struggling to ever change their opinions about us. And then us, our kids, who have nothing to do with the reasons why those bombs were dropped, and because they're so indoctrinated, they simply don't understand the power structure of the whole process, will go back into the war to fight those kids. And that's the ecosystem we are in now of war. And that's why it has to stop. I don't really have a lot of solutions for this. You know, I think that the solutions that I mentioned, which is a country has to vote on any act of war, whether it be indirectly declared or declared, would put a huge damper on the military industrial complex in any first world country, because we wouldn't vote for it most likely in a 2/3 majority unless they had a 9/11 and then we vote the very next day. But again, like the Brady Bill, maybe you're not allowed to vote on war right away. Maybe you have to vote on it several times before the bombs are actually dropped, before retaliation happens. And of course, the citizens would be like me when you bought 9/11 the way it came, the way it was pitched to us. Hey, I was ready to make glass out of deserts in the first several months because I was totally indoctrinated with the ecosystem of my past. But once I woke up and figured out who was benefiting from these sort of things, it became very complex and frustrating. So I just want to put a little video out there and hopefully shake up the old standards, right? There are moments when war is necessary. But it's very similar to the standards that you would defend your own household. If someone comes into my house and I don't recognize them at all, and they don't talk really, really fast, and if they don't have words that convince me really, really fast that they have mistakenly entered my home, or that they are trying to protect me from a huge fire that's coming my way, or some other global threat, or if they're not my neighbor, again, like I said, I don't recognize them. They might be my neighbor and I simply don't know their face. But if they're inside my home, it's a countdown. It's a countdown for their life. And that's maybe a justifiable reason to go to a small war in your own home. Same thing can happen to your country. If we get infiltrated, or anybody gets infiltrated by one of these factions that has been essentially convinced, it's not time to lay down arms, obviously. We have to get rid of those infected minds. And you can't afford to sit and debate it with them and try to sign a little treaty in your front room. Unfortunately, they're going to have to be removed from this planet and go back and renew, okay? But we can do a lot to stop the breeding of this mind share in humanity, both in our countries and in the countries that are being attacked. But I think the best thing we could possibly do is try to stop this indirect aggression that we have on these countries. Get everything settled down a little bit. Maybe issue a few apologies from the people to the people and say, we were drunk just like you on indoctrination from these powers. We have done what we can to remove these people from power. We put in processes to govern anyone ever achieving that level of control. We've rewritten the war crimes to include a lot more sub-violations. Those who aid and abet before, those who abet after the fact. And we've made it a lot more difficult for us to ever authorize dropping bombs on you again. Peace be with you, right? Maybe we even pay restitution. Maybe take out some loans to rebuild some of their worlds instead of faking rebuilding like we did after Desert Storm and the attacks of 2003 in the Middle East. We actually do it. Maybe just give them the money and they rebuild their own world. I don't know all the solutions. But this is one of those episodes where I believe that you guys have way, way more solutions than me. So, all I can say is please go out and do what you can to sort of settle everybody down, to add perspective. And I'll leave you with this one story, and then I'll shut up. I was at a restaurant here in Huntington Beach, and it was during sort of the height of some of our attacks in the Middle East. And this old Italian guy was at the end of the bar, tiny guy, old dude, and he was yelling at the TV how we should go over and bomb all these countries. And I sat there and I listened to him go off, and I could just hear the indoctrination just, you know, vomiting out of his mouth, right? He had diarrhea of the mouth and total war indoctrinated mindset. I slowly let him get done, and I looked at him, and I said, is that what we really should do? I said, you're sitting here in the comfort of this beautiful restaurant, watching TV at a bar, and you realize with every word that's coming out of your mouth, if anybody was here to listen to you, and if anybody just took your words and your actions at face value and engaged in the wars that you're talking about, then you have personally killed a bunch of Americans right here, right now, and you've killed it. Probably 10x people in those regions. This is that what you want on your soul? Is that what you want? Is there no other solution for this? And the guy's face completely went deer-eyed for a split second. And he shut up. And I was pretty confrontational with the guy. I raised my voice just a little bit. Didn't really raise it, but I was definitely being stern with the guy. Just to say, dude, do you have no other solution? You're an old guy and you didn't gain any wisdom in your full journey of life, but to carry this indoctrination banner with you? And the night went on, and I was probably there a couple hours, and eventually scooted up next to me. And he said, you know what? You're right. I haven't thought this thing through. I got caught up in the moment, and I shouldn't have said that stuff publicly, and I shouldn't probably be having such knee-jerk thoughts about war. Because I did grow up through Vietnam. I did have friends that came back really screwed up and a bunch of friends that didn't come back at all. And now I know that war was complete bunk. It was completely useless war. And I said, good. And I didn't mean to get up your ass, but let's just relax, right? Now, we all need to have outbursts like that every once in a while just to hear ourselves say things that are dumb. But if you ever catch yourself in that loop, I hope to God you're in your car, you're in your living room, you're nowhere where you can be heard. You know, get it out of your system when you're in private. And maybe you're right in the particular case that you're addressing. But let's at least retard our comments from our thoughts and try to put some more thought into this thing. I know you feel me. I'm going to shut up, like I said. If you made it this far, thanks for listening. As always, please subscribe if you dig these videos. They're not going to always be this dark. I didn't really want to make this video, but I thought, if I skip over low-hanging fruit and obvious things that I know or I believe in or I believe might be true, then I'm not really doing anybody a service in this planet. I want the world to be peaceful. I think that 99.9% of every human being on this planet does not want war, and the only people that do gain from it. So let's isolate those who gain from war, and let's remove them from society. If nothing else, just, I don't mean you can kill them if you want, but I just think, let's just get them out of the power structure. Let's disable them. Let's enucleate their cells. Society is on a real slippery slope right now, right? Bunch of agendas are completely out of control on this planet. All I can say is, as a guiding light, look at the inalienable rights as dictated by the United States Constitution as it was originally written. If you need to, go back to Magna Carta if you're in Europe and you don't want to give the cowboys any credit for copying what you guys started, which was a great idea. Make sure you protect your freedom of speech. I mean, protect it. Don't let people bully you through political correctness, because you'll lose this ability to talk correctly. get back your gun rights, because it's not for hunting, people. It's not for hunting. And you better believe the leaders of the world are looking at America with nervous eyes, because they know if they try to take this country over, the military is outnumbered 1,000 to 1. Right? And the military would not do it in the first place. Our military is built out of the most heroic individuals, and that goes for every one of your countries. They're there to protect the sovereignty of your country. But there's no sense in sending them off to war to get injured and maimed and killed if what they're fighting for isn't the rule base that we want to protect. Right? You feel me? I'll just say this. We're all here to learn the rules that rule us. Everything I've told you in this video rules you. And if you didn't know it, now you know it. There's a lot more to this than what I've put in here. What I've tried to do is keep out of all the conspiracies that are fringy. Everything I've said in here, I believe, is very easy to verify. And I think empirically most of you know this is true, even if this is the first show you've ever listened to. Even if you believe that everything written in the books of history is true, I think you'll be able to find that this is true and that you felt it your whole life, and now you know. There's a lot more investigation you can go do. Please do it. We're not benefiting from these wars personally, except to the degree that we buy into these paradigms that are bad for us in the first place. So let's re-engineer the mind. That's what the show's all about, right? Go take care of yourself and somebody else, and let's make some more shows. See you in the next one. Over and out.